a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
You're putting me on the spot, man. I don't like it. You got me all nervous for no reason.
Well, that's what happens when you join the podcast. You get all nervous, and you have to do intros.
All right. Welcome to Cue It Up Podcast. And no, this is not your normal host. This is not Nate Mindum talking to you as the intro comes in. It is Nick Olson, the host of Chalk is Cheap Podcast. And if you're wondering if you're on the right dial, if you need to change the channel.
You're not.
You don't. You're in the right spot.
Oh, I wanted to trick him.
So, gentlemen, how are we doing? Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Welcome, Nick. It's an honor, man.
I was actually expecting you not to talk there, Demetrius. Three people back on the air. I figured you'd probably just go back to, like, talking 20 minutes at a time or not at all.
I'm trying to grow. It's you know, my life coach told me.
We're working on it. Every day we get better and better, or we don't, but I like to think we do. So let's go with that anyways. I like that. Well, everybody, we are back for another week. And as you heard, we are being joined this week for the first time ever by Nick Olson. What's up, Nick?
Hey guys, you know, and you know, Demetrius, you said it was an honor, but really it's an honor for me. You know, I'm just a guy who likes to play pool and shares a commonality with you guys and likes to talk about it and hopes that we can continue to promoting the sport that we love. And I'm just happy to be a part of it. So, again, thank you for having me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we definitely need more mediums in the game, talking about it, bringing up stories, covering it, doing all that good stuff. So, anybody who's in the industry that I can help out along the way, especially since you just started, what did you start about 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago?
You know, it's amazing because it seems like I just started, and then I went back the other day and looked at some of the dates, and I think the first one was back in May. So yeah, it's been a few months already, and it's kind of been a whirlwind. It's been a lot of fun for me because, like you said, you know, just listening to, you know, the people that I've had on that, you know, tell their stories. And And, you know, who doesn't like hearing about old pool hall stories and gambling stories and stuff like that? I think it's fun for anybody. You don't even really have to be a pool hall junkie or, you know, crazy about billiards to enjoy some of the stories. So it's been a blast for me.
Yeah. So, and one of the reasons I'm definitely really excited to help you out as well is because you're doing something not completely different than what we're doing over here at the Cue It Up podcast, but you're doing something definitely unique to the billiard world. So why don't you give a little rundown as to what you actually do with your podcast and how you go about doing your interviews? Cause it's pretty cool. Like you said.
Yeah. You know, really, I guess I'll rewind it a little bit. Really the idea I came up with the idea about 5 years ago. I was just sitting down at the pool room one night and I was looking around and, you know, for the most part in the area that I grew up in, that I played pool in my whole life, for the most part it's a lot of older guys and gals that play. I mean, they're north of 40, north of 50. They've been around a long time, and I just started looking around and I thought, you know what, I bet you there's so many good stories in this room right now. I mean, you could probably do a radio show or a podcast on it. And I thought about what I said and it's like, you know what, you got something there. So I kind of just sat with it for a while. And I did a couple other podcast ventures that I had fun with. And you know, you realize once you get into podcasting, and you guys can attest to this, that it sounds all well and good and it's really fun and you have fun doing the show, but all the other work that comes along with it really starts to take a toll on you after a while. And you have to really commit to it to really make it good and make it to what you want it to become. So, you know, those other podcast ventures and things like that I had kind of came to an end. And when the whole COVID-19 thing came around and everything started shutting down and we weren't working and everything else, it just came back to me. And I thought, you know what, this is a perfect time to start talking about this and to create this podcast. So I kind of, you know, went through the avenues that you have to go through where you get hosting and you know, you figure out what you're going to do for production and those types of things, and started brainstorming for a name. And I just came up with the name out of nowhere. It's just, you know, what are some sayings that people say, you know, when you're playing the game? And one of those things that I always heard the old timers say, anytime somebody miscued was, hey, chalk is cheap. Chalk is cheap. Put chalk on your cue, you know. And so it's just one of those things that's got a nice ring to it. So that's what I went with. But I guess to address your actual question, and now I'm starting to ramble, but to address your actual question of what I do, basically the gist of the show is I'm going to do the show in sort of series, almost like, you know, if you were to tune into a television show and you had a season and then you waited a while and then there'd be another season. That's kind of the idea that I have. And this first series that I started working on was really geared toward the local people from the Twin Ports area, Duluth, Minnesota, and Superior, Wisconsin. About 150,000, you know, population, give or take, but it's got a really rich pool history in the area. There's always been pool rooms and billiard halls, you know, going back to the beginning of time of people going, people living in the area. So there's just so much history in the game and a really, just an abundance of really good pool players. So I've taken now, I'm on episode 13. So there's been 11 individuals and one memorial episode. So I've brought 11, you know, what I'm calling legends, and basically legends of our area have come on. And really, we don't talk too much about the technical side of things. You know, we're not going to talk about mechanics and how to set up and, you know, English on different shots and things like that. And, you know, pattern play. We might get into some of that stuff. But for the most part, really the gist of the show is we're talking about how life used to be, you know, some stories about, you know, going back in the day, and I know, Nate, you thought some of this was interesting when you first got tuned on to the show, you know, talking about these old pool rooms where women weren't allowed, what that was like, you know, cigar smoke in the air, cigarette smoke in the air, you know, what it was like where you'd have to play somebody for time or play somebody for money, and how that whole thing sort of, you know, happened and how it's different from today. So really that's the gist of it, kind of take you back in time a little bit and listen to how these people got their start and why they love the game. So that was a really long-winded answer, and I apologize, but that's really the gist of the show.
That was only 3 minutes. I gotta work with you, Nick. You got 17 minutes short.
Yeah, you want long-winded. We'll hook you up with Demetrius for a little while. He'll teach you the ways of the long-winded answer. No, that's awesome.
Yeah, I got some work to do, I think. Well, we'll see. We've got more time here. Maybe I can extend that a little bit.
Yeah.
You're just getting warmed up. You're going to catch a gear.
So we're going to bring you on today, and we're going to, you know, chat with you about, well, basically going to incorporate into what we do here. And if people basically like what you they're hearing and they like the way that you address yourself, where can they find your podcast after this?
Well, you know, as you know, the podcast platform world is very weird to me. I'm a numbers guy, so I like to look at my stats and my demographics and sources and numbers of how people listen and where they listen. And it boggles my mind every day that they find a new place to listen to my show on. And I don't understand how it works, but it does. But really, the main place you can go now is chalkischeappod.com. I'm finding that people are liking just to have a home base to go to. So you can find every single episode on Chalk is Cheap Pod. That's P-O-D, pod, short for podcast.com. But any place that you listen to podcasts, so if you're listening to this feed on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify and iHeartRadio, any of those types of things where you listen to podcasts, you can find us. We're everywhere.
Perfect. Easy as it gets. So, I mean, unless you're listening to my podcast on Podbean, which is my hosting website, pretty much anywhere else you should be able to find Nick's podcast.
Yep, exactly. We're everywhere except it. But that's, again, you know, wherever you pick your hosting site, I guess, is kind of significant there. Because like you said, we're not on Podbean, and you're not on Spreaker, and we're on Spreaker. So other than that, you know, you can find it just about everywhere.
Yep. All right. Well, I guess with all that introduction out of the way, we can actually jump into the podcast. Yes, this is going to be a normal recap episode. But we will get the announcements out of the way in the beginning. All right, so we will get it started with a Patreon update. We have not had any more new Patreons for the podcast, but I did want to get a plug in for it each week, especially in the next few, as I I guess, go out there and begin looking for jobs. So maybe this would be a last gasp effort to try to justify hanging around doing the podcast more full time. But I did want to get that plug in. So if you are interested in becoming a Patreon to the podcast, you can do that at patreon.com/queueitup. Or you can head over to the Facebook, and the link for that will be on all of the posts for the podcasts. And if you needed more of a reason to, I still have Patreon prizes that I guess I haven't been really giving the rest of those away because the whole COVID-19 thing happened, and I guess they were always going to be incentives to motivate people to go out there and sign up for the Patreon if they were interested in doing so. And then COVID happened. I just didn't feel right asking people to potentially, I guess, support something with the financial insecurities with the whole COVID lockdown. So, but now that the economy and everything else is starting to open up a little bit more, I will be giving away more of those Patreon prizes. And I think I'll start probably later this week, maybe Thursday or Friday, and I will do another Facebook Live giveaway for Patreon gifts. So I will get another winner in this coming Thursday or Friday, however it is. I'll get people plenty enough time. Or maybe actually what I'll do is I'll do next Monday. I'll do next Monday. That gives everybody plenty of time to listen to the podcast, and if they were interested in becoming a Patreon, they'd have plenty of time to be able to do so before I actually do the drawing. So I'll do that next Monday, which I guess would be the 29th. So that will be happening soon. Also, I will say that there is a raffle out on the podcast page as well. So if you like raffles, you could win a bunch of really cool prizes. The big ticket item is a $1,500 Predator Icon pool cue, which was donated by Q World, which is a Australian company. But there's also lots of other prizes there. I think there's like 15 prizes or something like that. So you can head over there, and if you're a raffle person, and get in that if you'd like. There's only about 50 tickets left. So once the tickets are gone, we will do the drawing for that. And then lastly, we are looking for more listener questions. We have had a couple of them come in the last few days, but we are looking for more. So if you have any questions for myself, Demetrius, Rob, or any of the other people that are on the podcast, like Nick for today, get your questions over to us and we will answer them on air. And lastly, and this is a lot of shout outs, but lastly, I want to do the read for the iTunes reviews. And I try to do these once a week so that basically, you know, we can motivate people to go over there and leave them because they actually are pretty helpful as far as the iTunes algorithm to give suggested podcasts to other people. So I will do this one this week, and this is kind of a long one, but it's a good one. This is from Twiggy Sawdust. Nate does an outstanding job with the Cue It Up Billiards podcast. I've been a listener for about 3 months, and I've been impressed with the professionalism and content Nate and Rob are putting out into the world free of charge. So this is back in January 16th, so this was pre-Demetrius. The podcast stays updated with fresh content and with a focus on current tournament results, player interviews, and other happenings in the billiard world. If anyone is a pool enthusiast, you should definitely support Nate and Rob by subscribing to his podcast and giving them a superb rating that reflects on the quality content they are putting out there to provide us. Anytime somebody in the pool world does something like this for free in order to grow the sport, we as fans should go out of our way to support them. I know I will. That is a really, really nice review. I feel all special now. Thanks, Twiggy Sawdust. Okay, so I guess with that, we can get started with our shout-outs. Nick, you are our guest, so why don't you be our very first shout-out? Who are you shouting out to?
All right, so I'm going to shout out one of the guys that I just had a guest on my podcast because he and I were chatting about ants, and if you listen to that episode, there's part of it that made the episode, but every single year, I don't know if you guys are homeowners or what your situation is, but for me, every single year I battle ants. And I don't know if you ever seen that Elmer Fudd cartoon back in the day where he's taking on the ants and he's blasting them with a shotgun and all that stuff. That's basically what I do. And besides the shotgun, but I mean, I feel like I'm Elmer Fudd trying to fight my aunt. So anyways, he and I were talking about some of these things that you can do to get rid of ants. And apparently he said, well, this, some of the stuff is illegal, so don't repeat this. But I haven't gotten into everything that he does, but he gave me some ideas on how to get rid of ants from your property and your home. So I'm gonna shout out good old Robbie Dugard, because he's going to help me out with my ant problem. So there's my shout out.
Well, there you go. That's probably the most unique shout out I think we've had thus far.
We're going to have to edit this, so I go first. I can't follow that. my shout out, I guess I'm going to shout out to the fathers. We're recording this. It's Father's Day. I don't know when it'll drop, but here's the thing. My dad doesn't listen. I'll have to call him. I like the way I say it. But anyway, I'd like to shout out to all the fathers because, there's not enough I can say, but I also know in particular for all the pool playing fathers, it's hard, when you're passionate about the game and it's really, really, there's a lot of players out there that we don't know. We know the Josh Fillers, we know the Shanes, we know the Tony Johans, but we don't know all the players that didn't get to the top levels, that didn't become famous and well known because they've made sacrifices to raise children and to love their kids and make sure that they're cared for and all that. And so it's like, I don't know all of you, but that's a really noble and it's priceless, and thank you. And actually for that reason, and I have also got a question to stick around because I got a listener question about how to achieve a good life pool balance. And so I'll be talking about that in my coach's corner. So thanks, Dad.
Ah, you kind of stole my shout out, which is actually going to be to my dad. And he actually does listen to this podcast. So boom, Demetrius, my dad likes me more than your dad likes you. Ha ha ha. No, joking, of course. But he actually does listen to the podcast. He's been pretty supportive along the way. He's got some hoodies and some shirts that I've made up, all the swag stuff. So he supports the podcast and he listens as well every single week. I think he sits down every week with my sister and I think they listen to the podcast, which is kind of cool. But I'll give a shout out to my dad, Warren Mindham, for listening to the podcast. And I guess with that, we can jump into the recap of the podcast. So this segment is just going to be with Demetrius and I. So we are going to recap what happened with the Francisco Bustamante and the Tony Chohan one pocket matchup. Rob isn't here this week, but I think he nailed it. I think the final score was 24-22, and I think that's exactly what he predicted. I don't remember what you predicted, Demetrius. I think I had 24-20, and it was looking pretty good like that for a little while, and then Tony made another last kind of gasp or kind of a last second push to really actually make that really tight. It was a fun match to watch.
Yeah, I actually, funny enough, I don't remember my prediction on the air, because what I remember was that I went through, like, when I first heard about the match, I'm like, ooh, this is a race. And then I thought about it a little bit. I'm like, maybe Tony has a tiny edge. And then I thought about it a little bit more. And I'm like, maybe it's a race. And then you influenced me, because then you thought Boosty. And I'm like, well, maybe Boosty. And then I heard that it's got tight pockets. I'm like, yeah, tight pockets, Filipino, probably a little bit, it's a race, but I'd tip up a little Boosty's way. And so I probably predicted Boosty to win. But, like, in my heart, I was like, I thought it was a really close match, and I definitely thought it could go either way. I did think that with tight pockets, that's a good sign. Like, I think if they played on the same table that the Royce Baseman table was on, it might have gone the other way, or it might have been more of a true race anyway. But I think with tighter pockets, I got to give Boosty the pull. But it could have been much closer, I'll tell you that. It could not have been much closer.
Yeah. And it was, for anybody who watched it, you know exactly how entertaining it was. Because, first off, I should say it was a little bit different going from Joshua Filler and Tony Chohan to this. I mean, it took me a little while to actually transition back into the way one pocket normally looks. But so the match started out 5-0 Boosty, and then it went to 7-2 Boosty. And Tony actually won the first day 8-7, which was just crazy. And then day two was mostly back and forth. Tony'd win two games, Boosty would win one game. Tony would win a game, Boosty would win two. It was basically back and forth. I think Boosty ended up winning the day What did he? I think he ended up winning 9-6.
It was 16-14 at the end of day two.
Yeah,
and then
so he won 9-6.
Then Tony won the first two games, so ended up at 16 apiece out of the third day. So I mean, it was basically tied up and then tied up again. I mean, it was really, really close.
Yeah.
And then it was knotted up at 19-19 as well. So, you know, basically a race. After all that, it was a race to five. Boosty, I believe, ended up getting out to 20. Was it 22-19 at that point?
Correct. Yep.
And then Tony got it back to 22-21, and then Boosty got to the hill, and then Tony got to 22, and then Boosty cleared it out from there to win 24-22. So, but I guess the point of this is they were back and forth after day one. I mean, day one was huge swings, and then other than that, it was basically back and forth, back and forth. It was really, really entertaining match as far as the trend line of it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Boosty, it seemed like the tale of the story in terms of the score was that Boosty would jump out to a lead, and then Tony would make these bad charges to come crashing back in and either take the lead as he did at day one or just tie it back up. And then Boosty got a little ahead, and Tony came a little bit back. And then at the end, Boosty got ahead, like you said, 22-19, and then Tony came back and won the next couple to kind of get back where it was. Boy, we could talk more about the details of the way that game played out because that was a fun game. But anyway, on the one hand, like Boosty tended to be doing the front running, but on the other hand, Tony was always able to charge back. And when it comes to a 24-22 scoreline, particularly when the game that Boosty won to get to the hill came down to one ball that went both ways and they both had shots to win it and they both missed winning shots. Like when things are that close, I would say it this way. A lot of those matches, it used to be with like Scott Frost and Alex from years ago, where it would be like everybody would win on their break and it would be 1-1 or 1-0, 1-1, 2-1, 2-2, 3-2, 3-3. And then in a situation like that, when somebody gets a two-game lead, that's like, well, it's actually kind of significant. But when people are taking turns with massive momentum and winning 3, 4, 5 games in a row and on both sides, you know, Boosty jumping out 5 games ahead and then, you know, Tony charging back with a 5 or 6 game string. It's like who's got the break and who's, you know, it's not taking turns winning games. And so what that means is that, you know, a 24-22 scoreline in that type of, you know, frenzy of momentum swings, you know, I don't know, man, if they've been playing to 26, we might've gotten a different result. I mean, that's how swingy and how momentum it was. And definitely Tony had the momentum at the end. It was just a little too late. But then Boosty won the match and that's what it counts. So I guess what I would say is that the more back and forth during the match it is, the more a two game or margin is. And the way that game played out, it was fireworks the whole way.
Yeah. And I think let's take a little bit more of a deep dive into the match, because I think the match was won on rack 40, I think, right? Because it was 22. No, it was, what was it? 20.
It was
22-21.
When it was 22-21, Bustamante, yeah. That game was critical. Yeah.
Yes.
And here's why it was critical is because you'd think, well, if Boosty loses, it's 22 apiece. Why would that be such a big difference? So I'll let you go first, but I want to answer the question, why, if it's 22-21, did it feel like Bustamante had to have that game to win? Why was that game so critical, Nate?
And for anybody who's listening to this, Demetrius and I were watching this live together. So we were on the phone and we ended up going to bed at like 3:30 that morning or something like that when it finished up, something like that.
That's actually why the podcast is not dropping till today. We were supposed to do it on Friday morning, but we were watching this until wee hours. So yeah.
Yeah. No way that was happening. So, we're watching this together. We're on the phone watching it and it was actually really fun because we were almost like we were commentating the match. We weren't talking like we were friends. We were talking as if we were watching the match and commentating, which was actually kind of fun. I think if given the opportunity in the future, I think it'd be really fun to try to talk to one of these promoters and try to do some sort of cross promotion where we do the commentary for their event or something like that. I think that'd be a lot of fun. But So basically, I guess going into this match, we were talking, and I was actually even disagreeing with you when we were doing it to a point. It was 22-21, and this game took an hour and a half, and it started out with. it started out with Tony. Well, let me answer your question, and we'll actually talk about the details of the game, because I think they're extremely, extremely important to probably talk about these. So I didn't think it was a necessarily must-win game, but I know I would have been shaken in my gosh darn boots if Fusty would have lost that. And that's because he would have lost three straight. I mean, he had won three straight. It was knotted up at 19, and he won three straight. And at that point in time, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. For anybody, you know, we had a little bit of a wager on this. It wasn't huge, but, you know, we like to sweat these games because, you know, that's what we do. It's fun. So we had a little bit of a wager on this, and I'm feeling pretty good at 22-19 with my boosty pick. And it gets to 20, you know, basically he wins three straight games. And then if he loses three straight games, I'm shaking in my boots, but I still, I mean, if I like Boosty in a race of 24 and you take away the swings of the match and you just look at the analytics of, you know, who do I think is a favorite in a race of two between Boosty and Tony, I still like Boosty. I like Boosty in any race, but I would have been shaking in my boots and I did not want that to happen.
Well, it's funny because at 19-19, I texted you that I was feeling a little pessimistic about Boosty. And then he won three in a row to go up 22-19. And you texted me back, still feeling pessimistic, LOL. And I texted back, yes, LOL. So because I did not feel like when he got up 22-19, I did not feel like what was going to happen is he was going to carry that three-game lead and ease it to a 24-20 victory. That is not the way I thought that was going down. I'm like, Tony is going to still, you know, he's rallied back every other time. Boosty has shown a lot of – the other thing is Boosty's been showing a lot of fatigue later in the days. I think – and I'll just insert this now. I think that, you know, when Efren went from being really dominant to having kind of a 10-year stretch where he was still playing world class, but it was hot and cold. It was a little patchier. He didn't – wasn't as steady, and a lot of times fatigue started to take a toll. And that was probably, you know, the last 10, 12 years. I feel like Boosty is kind of reaching that. You know, he's 54. Nobody lives forever, man, and he still plays great. But it seemed like he would charge to a lead every day, and then he'd wear down and start playing a little shaky, and Tony just was waiting for it. Like, Tony was expecting it. So the same thing, he got ahead 22-19. But as we saw, those last, you know, 5-6 games took as long as the first 10, and I just felt like based on the way things had been going, he was very vulnerable. And so – so then at 22-19, when he starts wearing down and Tony starts winning a few games to go up, you know, to 22-20, then 22-21. And then before we get into how that game played out, the other thing I'd say is if it went 22-22, Tony has two of the last three breaks, which maybe doesn't mean as much given the way these things are playing out. But he also has the momentum. He has the energy. Boosty's wearing down. And I just feel that if Boosty had lost that game, I'm not saying he wouldn't have won the set, but I actually would have made him an underdog. So I felt like it was critical that Boosty got on the hill before it got to 22.
Yeah.
So now we can talk about that game in particular, because one of the keys of that game, in my opinion, was the fact that Boosty got ahead 7-0 on ball count that game. So now he's at 22-21 in game count, and he's up 7-0. If he can make that last ball, he's up 23-21. But if he struggled,
if you don't mind me jumping in here, I think we should start at the beginning too, because obviously that's an important part of it. But Tony had the best break he'd probably had in the entire event. He had a ball hanging in his jaws. He had a ball above and below the pocket on the bottom rail and the side rail, which is, I mean, that is almost a checkmate break. And Boosty jacks up, makes a fantastic clearance of the ball in front of his pocket, and basically just switches the entire layout of the table. And I mean, in like dominating fashion, he basically takes Tony's amazing break and says, "Oh yeah, watch this."
Is that the one where he made the 10-ball bank first and then and then hung up and hooked Tony, so then Tony had to take out Boosty's ball and he kind of allowed Boosty to turn things around?
So Boosty hangs a ball and basically hooks him on not being allowing to get it to the ball in front of his pocket. And then, yes, through Tony clearing that, Boosty ends up kind of hitting a crazy shot and clearing out basically his pocket. or of the ball hanging. I think it was a seven ball, if I'm not mistaken, that was hanging in his pocket basically without making it. And
you're right.
And swapping the entire table.
Yeah, Boosty had to come with some serious magic to not lose immediately after that break, and to be able to hang up a ball in his pocket and hook Tony off his off Tony's hanging ball to where you can't come. I mean, if Tony can't find a way to combo in a hanging ball, you know that Boosty did his job.
Yes. Yeah. And then so then we get to what you were talking about, where Boosty basically just outmaneuvers him for 6, 7, 8 straight innings and getting out seven balls. So take it away from there.
Yeah, so Boosty gets up 7-0. And what I hadn't watched the whole match, but I'd seen a few games where Boosty got ahead like 7-2 or something, and Tony was able to come back and win. And the end games that I had seen that were 7-6, 7-7, 6-6, I had seen those all go in favor. Like Tony, all I'd seen is Tony win those end games, which I want to come back to in a minute. But I'll say that what happened is Boosty got up 7-0. And then Tony, once again, was doing 80% of the aggressive shooting. Boosty's trying to keep him off his pocket. He's always trying to take balls out of Tony's pocket. Tony's always finding ways to bank him back and put him in funny spots. And when Boosty did get bank shots at his hole, like long rail backcut banks, you could tell when somebody's in a state of mind where like, ooh, I have a chance. I think I'm going to send this towards the hole. Maybe I can win it now. Versus when they're kind of going through the motions like, hopefully this, you know, I want to just send it towards my hole and take some pressure off me for a minute. And maybe I'll get really lucky and it'll find its way in the hole. And when you're in that state of mind, it doesn't go in. And Boosty was clearly in a state of mind where he was not in danger of making those banks. He was just sending those up and reeling from the aggression of Tony. And so what the score played out was from 7-0 to 7-1 to 7-2 to 7-4 to 7-5 to 7-6 to 7-5 again, because Tony scratched and Boosty actually at that point had a spot shot and he missed the spot shot. And then it went 7-6, 7-7, and Tony had the first shot to win. So before we even go in, well, I'm sorry, the second shot, because the spot shot was missed. But the main point is, before we even talk about the turnovers, is like when Boosty has a 7-0 lead and he's up 22-21, if he can't win with a seven ball lead to get to the hill, now Tony's breaking at 22 apiece. If Boosty couldn't win the last game, how do you like him trying to win from there? It's just and if you feel like, boy, do you feel devastated if you can't win that game after having a 7-0 lead and missing a spot shot. If it comes down to a race to two, you just feel like, if I can't win from there, where can I win? I know Boosty's a champion. He's not supposed to think that way, but that's why I think it would have been particularly devastating, and it would have been hard to shake that one off.
Yeah, and as you hinted, Boosty actually had a couple of opportunities. He had a couple of good bank shots, and he had a spot shot where Tony actually scratched. He didn't make a ball. He just had a fluke scratch trying to play safety and left Boosty a spot shot, right? And
yeah,
Boosty misses it by 3/4 of a diamond, and Tony gets that ball back almost immediately. I don't think it was on the next shot, but I think it was his next inning after scratching. He got that ball back immediately, and it was back to 7-7 again, and they're fighting over one ball. And I mean, how many bank shots were missed, or two rails or three railers that were missed by Tony in that game, to basically, you know, not great ones, but good ones. Like, you know, you would suspect him to make 40% of what. There was a one point in time, I think we were having this discussion where we had kind of basically said, well, he's a 45% favorite to make the shot, or a 60% favorite to make the shot, or a 35%. And we basically had about 6 different instances where if you average them all out, he basically lost 6 coin flips by missing all of those bank shots. And
it just goes to show, man, the pressure involved in pool, because it's like in any other, if it was 4-4, he would have made half those shots. But it was when it's 22-21, and this is for his tournament life, so to speak, that it's like, it's just amazingly difficult to, I mean, that's what is amazing about one pocket and bank pool too, if anybody plays bank pool, is that, you know, in 9-ball or bar table 8-ball, you can get layouts where it's like, doesn't matter how nervous you are, you're going to run those 3 balls. You're on 5-inch pockets and everything's at a bar table. Or, you know, you can run those 4 balls in rotation because, yeah, you're nervous, but you're a good player and they're laying open and you can just kind of wobble them in and get the job done. Whereas in bank pool and one pocket, there are times when it doesn't, you know, if you're nervous and tight, these, you know, when your back cut banking balls linked to the table, you, it doesn't matter if you get 3-4 shots at him. You have to be feeling, you have to be in a happy spot to make those shots. Even if you're a great banker, you can't just kind of close your eyes and shoot them towards the hole and hope they go. Like, you have to make them go. And it's just funny how, when you're under a lot of heat, both players were just not in a spot where they could, make those balls go in the pocket.
Yeah, for sure.
The only other thing that I was going to say is that I believe that the couple key differences between this and a normal one-pocket match, I think that in general we've seen a lot of swingy one-pocket where, like, Filler and Chohan was the same way, where there was, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 game swings. And that I think that's partly due to the aggressive nature of the game. I know that there was a lot of conversation about this on AZ Billiards and people talking about how much Tony has changed the game, just even in the last 10 years since the Efren days, and how it used to be even just 5 years ago. I think when Tony plays matches, there seems to be big swings, just due to the aggression and the momentum involved. And then the other part that I wanted to mention was that bit about that comeback from 7-0. This is something I was talking to you about when we were watching that hour and a half end game, is that I feel that when one guy can outplay the other guy in the end game, it's really, really hard for the other player. It's such a big advantage to be able to outplay in the end game. And we saw this, there was a match where Dennis Arculo played Scott Frost probably 5 years ago. And Scott would have Dennis down 7-0, 7-1 in these games. And Dennis would win over half of them. Like, basically, if the balls moved up table, he'd win over half of them because he executed and moved his cue ball speed and his banking was so strong that Scott just couldn't put him away. And then Dennis went on and won that match, and, you know, 40 to, you know, 30, 32 or 29 or whatever it was. But it was so lopsided because of that. And that was really the big difference in, you know, banking and end games. And so I feel like when one person has a dominant advantage in the end game to the point where when the other guy gets you down 7-2, they feel like they're not sure if they can put it away, it's a double whammy. First, you know, maybe somewhere between a quarter and a half the games go to end games. So it's like, if a third of the games go to end games and you're losing almost all of them, that's just really, really hard to outrun. And you have to win all the down table games. But the other part is that it puts a lot of pressure on you to force the action. So when the balls are down table, you kind of get into a spot where you're like, well, if the balls go up table, I can't win. So now I can't just sit here and play the right shot that I would normally play. I have to play a shot that's going to force actions, keep balls down table. You know, I can't just be patient and win. I have to find a way to win before I inevitably lose. And I just think that between being outplayed in so many end games and then having to shoot suboptimal shot selections, trying to keep the balls from going up table, I feel like being at a disadvantage in the end game, it's almost insurmountable. Not insurmountable, but it's a huge, huge deal. And I think it just really goes to show how good Boosty actually plays, that he was able to basically spot Tony the end games and still win.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree basically with just about everything that you said. So I won't expand upon that. But there's still one thing that I would like to talk about. And it was kind of going into this. Well, actually, two things. But they're kind of connected. I know in the beginning, I had kind of thought that the top three one-pocket players who I viewed were the best in the world, being Alex, Dennis, Boosty, in that order. I had kind of thought that they were kind of a step away from the rest of the players in the world. And after the conclusion of this match, I guess I would like to chat a little bit about where we are now with that, whether it's you or me, basically how we view the rest of the players in the world after this matchup. And then maybe at the end of that, we could go back to the kind of thought experiment that we had with Filler and Boosty and what that would look like if they played. So
fair enough. Why don't you go first?
All right. So I kind of thought that the gap between Boosty and Tony was kind of pretty big, not Tony necessarily, but the rest of the world, which I kind of see being headed pretty closely by Tony. It's hard to say for sure because, of course, he just lost to Filler. So Filler's kind of this wild card. Where does he actually fit into the world? I mean, he's just such a strong cueist that, I mean, if he has any idea on how to play one pocket at all, he's going to be pretty strong. But, you know, there's probably ways to slow him down if you could get into those kind of up-table games. there's ways that you could, you know, have more success against him as opposed to just kind of trying to outpower him at the bottom of the table. But so I guess it's really hard to put him in with that group of people, especially with how aggressive Tony is. Maybe Joshua is just a really bad matchup for him because they both play this ultra-aggressive style. But I guess what I learned from this as far as Boosty and the rest of the world, or the top three in the rest of the world, I think I maybe didn't give Tony enough credit. I think Tony and maybe the rest of the world are a little bit closer to those top three, or at least Boosty, than maybe I had previously thought. And yeah, I think... which is good, ultimately, right? Because that's going to create more and interesting matchups. What I would like to see now is I would like to see maybe a Boosty versus a Josh Roberts, or maybe even a Chip Compton, maybe with a couple games on the wire, something like that. Just so we can get a little bit more of a diverse kind of matchup styles, where I can see Boosty playing against these other different top American players as well. Just to kind of, I don't know, maybe see how he stacks up with the rest of them, because like I said, Tony is kind of a unique player where he is that ultra aggressive kind of, let's, you know, kick one rail into the stack and move the entire thing over and hit it 50 miles an hour kind of player that is kind of unique to him. And I guess some of the players that have followed him have taken those shots on as well, but you didn't see old school players shoot that shot very often. So
yeah, so this is really cool. First of all, I think you've hit a couple of good points. One is Tony is a very, you know, different kind of player, and so it kind of changes how the matchups go. So I think there's a couple of good points. One is that Tony has changed a lot of the, you know, the dynamic of what the matches he plays don't look like the matches other people play. And I also think that there's a lot of room for diversity as far as we need to see different players playing. I love watching Tony play, and I love watching Boosty play, but it seems like the last number of big action matches have involved those two, and we haven't seen an action match with Dennis or Alex against anybody else for quite a while. They both played Tony, but other than that, they've been sitting on their title for years without ever played anybody else. We haven't really seen, you know, I mean, we've seen a lot of, so anyway, I agree, we could use more diversity in the game. But here's kind of what I think about this. I do think that Tony's a heck of a player, but I also feel that I maintain that as these matches are streamed more and more and more, I guarantee you Filler was watching that match. I guarantee you Roberto Gomez was watching that match. You know what I mean? So it's like everybody's learning this game. I maintain that the game is evolving in a couple ways. Number one, that the knowledge out there is such that the strikers and the top executors and strikers and players have an edge compared to the knowledge used to be more critical. And as people have gotten more knowledgeable and there's more information, the strikers will continue to have a bigger and bigger edge. And we're going to see it swing away from Tony and Josh Roberts to Gomez and Filler. Like, that's just what we're going to see. But the other part is that the game has evolved and become more aggressive. And Tony, to be fair to him, has changed one pocket. I mean, Scott Frost came out with Power One Pocket and everything, but I hate to say it, but Tony showed Scott Frost what Power One Pocket really is. But I think when you see Filler come along, he's saying, okay, we'll just do that then. And so even though Tony's been the really aggressive player, I think that if we watch other matchups, I think if we watch Gomez play Bustamante, I think it would be very aggressive. I think if we watch Filler play Alex, I think it'll be very aggressive. You know, people think Dennis and Alex could just shut Filler down. I'll tell you what, the problem, the reason why it's the same thing happened. It just reminds me of what happened in poker. It used to be that, you know, in 2003, people would raise before the flop and take down the blinds, or they'd raise before the flop and then they'd make a bet after the flop and everybody would fold. And then it's like within 10 years, it's like there's 3 bets, 4 bets, 5 bet bluffs, and everyone's got game theory telling them to, you know, hit the gas to the floor all the time and triple barrel off their stack. Like, the same thing is happening in one pocket. So Tony may have contributed to that charge, and I'll give him credit for that. And he may have been a very good player using that style. But now he's not the only one. And the thing about one pocket is that the more aggressive you play, and I talked about why Tony played this style against Fillers, the more aggressive you play, in theory, the more pressure that puts on your opponent, the more options you restrict your opponent. And as players get more and more and more aggressive, I mean, it's really tough to figure out where to leave Tony. But it's getting tough to figure – it's even tougher to figure out where to leave Filler. And it's really – so I actually think that Filler – is going to do better than people think, because I think that the knowledge gap is closed. The aggressive style, this is not just an aggressive player that does well with a style. I think this is the trend, and this is a dominant way to play one pocket, is hyper aggressive. And so when you get a hyper aggressive player like Filler, who's studying the game and also has the best striking in the world, I think he's the future. He may drop a set to Alex or Dennis, but I predict that he will be the top of the totem pole. And I think that the style, I think that what we're going to see as far as who are going to be the future leaders in one pocket, they're going to be really, really strong strikers that play hyper-aggressive. I think that's going to be the dominance of the future.
I think that's a discussion we're going to have in and of itself, because that we could actually really take a deep dive into the history of one pocket and the trend lines of the game that I don't think a discussion right here would do justice. So I think maybe we should have this discussion maybe next week or something. What do you think?
That's fine. I have a good with that. The only other thing I'd like to add about Tony is that, you know, I want to give him both credit, but I also want to be, you know, real, which is the credit I will give him is that he has demonstrated some of the most explosive one pocket anybody has ever seen in their life. He has influenced the game to where the game became, I think he's impacted the evolution of the game accordingly. And I also think that it's amazing that he was able to get in the ring with Dennis a few years ago and beat him in a race to 40. Somebody who the people thought was about the best in the world, or one of them. So I gave him the credit. But what I'll also say is that you may have felt that you had him overrated a hair, or I'm sorry, you might have felt that you underrated him a hair, but I also think that some people overrate him. And that's hard to say, because I think he is one of the best one pocket players in the world. When he's in his gear, it's a miracle to watch. And like I said, he influenced the game and all this. But here's the problem. He beat Dennis one match. And he did it in a way where Dennis was still fairly inexperienced to one pocket, didn't know what to expect playing Tony or how to play against him. He jumped out to an early lead on day one, and then they traded games, and Dennis wasn't able to catch the lead. So not only do I not feel like – so, yeah, he beat him that set, but really he beat him the first half of day one and then was able to stagger that lead to win that set. So as far as I'm concerned, he beat Dennis one set basically by ambushing him out of the gate on day one. And then when they rematched, he lost. He lost to Alex when they played their race to three, races to 10. He lost 3-0. He's lost to Filler. He's lost to Boosty in this long match. And Boosty, not only is not Dennis or Alex, but he's frankly, I don't even know if he's still at absolute top of his game anymore. And so when you look at it, what has Tony won? He hasn't won Derby. He hasn't made it through. He doesn't do well in tournament styles where they're short sets and you have to be consistent through a long series. So he hasn't won one pocket tournaments. He's not beating people in money games. What's impressive is that he's able to get in the ring with some of the best players in the world. And whether they're Filler or whether they're Boosty or whether they're Alex, he's making them all sweat.
Yeah. I think that's a fair critique to have at this point. In the end,
he's good enough to change the course of how the game evolves. He's good enough to get in the ring, and he's always a threat to beat anybody. But in the end, I still think that there is still a gap between the top strikers. And I still think that Tony may be in the running for the top five. Maybe you've got Alex and Dennis at the top. Maybe you've got, you know, Boosty and Filler. But I think that Filler and Gomez are climbing their way past. Well, nobody's paying attention.
Yeah. No, I think so, too. I think Superman, which is Gomez, I think he's a very, very sneakily underrated one pocket player. I guess the analogy I would do would be Mike Tyson, right? In boxing, he kind of revolutionized boxing to where, you know, he's never made a 35 second fight more exciting than ever before, but eventually you start losing, right? Eventually Mike Tyson starts getting knocked out and eventually you stop wanting to watch it. Are you suggesting that we're getting to the point where we're going to be not really interested in watching Tony Chioan play anymore?
No, I would like to see him book a winner though. I mean, I feel like he has every right to call out Filler. He has every right to call out Boosty, both in terms of resume and credentials, and also in terms of it's his money and he can do what he wants. And he's not on a line to play these matches. I mean, this match couldn't have been closer. And frankly, if you wanted a rematch, Boosty, I wouldn't think he's out of line to do that. At the same time, you know, you mentioned him playing other players. I'd like to see Tony play Gomez. That would be a fun match to see. You know,
that would be a great match.
that would be a much harder match to predict. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it would be. Yeah.
And so I hope Tony's around for a long time, and I hope that his best days of One Pocket are ahead of him. But I'd like to see him book some winners, because you know, it's not about yardage, man. This is like the Hustler. You know, it's not about yardage. At the end of the day, you count your money. And as great as Tony's played, and as explosive as his high gear looks, and as much as he's impacted the game, in the end, you got to look at the wins and losses. And he hasn't booked a winner for years.
Yep.
And so if you want to, you know, if you really want to, you don't get credit for making a champion sweat. You get credit for getting the job done. And I'm not like, if you listen to this, like, I mean, trust me, that's the hard part. You got to give credit for, I mean, doing something that frankly nobody else in the world could have put such a test to Boosty and Filler. So because of how well he played and how much of a test he gave these players, you still got to put him right up there in the, you know, top five or whatever. But I'd just like to see him book a winner, or at least, you know, take one down.
Yep, I agree. Well, I guess we can leave that discussion there, and we can move on to the next part of the podcast. So normally we talk about the upcoming events right now, but there's not really a lot out there. There is a couple of matches that were planned and then maybe are now postponed, or who knows? They're in limbo from what I'm seeing. So we are going to skip the upcoming events this week, and we're going to talk more about our great guest, Nick. Nick, I want to know, you said that you had, in the beginning, you said that you are going to be doing seasons, and you are in the first one, which is a local Legends of Your Area season. But yep. That doesn't in any sort of way talk about what you have coming up. So why don't you take a little bit of time and talk about your future goals for the podcast and, you know, maybe different seasons you're hoping to have, or, you know, basically just tell us all of your hopes and dreams.
Yeah. Well, again, yeah. Like right now we're talking to some of the older guys and gals and the legends of the area, but we also have a new series going on right now too. That's right on the same feed at the same time that I'm calling the Diamond Cutters series. And what that really is I started doing this as kind of a prelude to some of our guests that we had on, just to have another segment on the show. And really the gist of it was, is I thought, why not highlight somebody around the globe that is promoting the game in a positive way, in some way, shape or form. So it could be, you know, somebody who posts videos on YouTube and a lot of people follow them and what they do help promotes the game. Or it could be a proprietor somewhere who owns a pool hall and is doing really cool things for charity or something like that. And so that whole series is kind of based around that. So the first one I did, I had a kid named Riley Schmidt, and he does trick shots. And what I thought was cool about Riley is that he was completely self-taught. He'd never, you know, watched pool on TV, really. He wasn't surrounded by the game. He didn't grow up in it. And his dad ended up winning a pool table from a raffle at his work. And this pool table just was all of a sudden in Riley's house. He didn't know what it was, what to do with it. So he pulled up YouTube like a lot of kids can do nowadays, which I guess is kind of an advantage to the young kids coming up right now that are into the game, because you can watch and find anything on YouTube. But anyway, he finds YouTube and starts watching, you know, the trick shot guys on YouTube, you know, whether it be Venom or you know, any of these guys. And he named a bunch on the show that he looks up to. And he just started learning, you know, everything there is to know about doing these trick shots. And he's amazing. And he's 14 years old. He's, like I said, he's self-taught. So, I mean, that's the kind of kid that really fits what I'm talking about, you know, just an amazing story and something interesting. So we've got that going on right now. And so that's going to run simultaneously with this Legend series that we're doing. And then, you know, in the future, I'm finding that, and you know, Nate and I, you and I have talked about this a little bit before, but really, after so long, if you're going to try to keep something local, you really need to kind of, you know, keep it fresh and keep your show new and fresh and keep finding things that people want to listen to. So I just think it's a natural sort of progression for me to just kind of, I guess, more or less move up the ladder and talk about things that pertain really to the national and international scene of pool. And whether that be talking to pro players or you know, talking to promoters or whatever that happens to be. You know, I'd love to go down that road in the future and maybe start a series of of pro players and different things like that. So I guess, you know, right now I wouldn't say we're at a limbo. I've got some goals to start talking to those sorts of people. But it's kind of a one step at a time thing and just see how things progress. But really, you know, that's kind of where I see it going, just as a natural progression, because after a while, if you just kind of keep things local, you're going to run out of people to talk to. And really, you know, that's why people tune into your show. I mean, they may enjoy listening to you talk, but really, if you have a good guest, that's what's going to get people to tune in. So just continuing to find interesting and guests that people are you know, drawn to, that they want to listen to.
I tell you what, I don't know you, Nick. So I'd like to know, yeah, like, what's your story with pool? And then, you know, what were you doing before? I mean, were you a student? Were you, I don't been here. I'm curious, you know, I feel like I'm coming in blind, because I live around your area, but I don't think we've crossed paths. And so I don't know much about you. I don't know your age, your occupation, what got you into pool. And certainly, you know, you kind of talked a little bit about what inspired you to create the podcast, but, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself outside of pool, and then how you got into pool in general.
Yeah, well, really, my whole life, I've been a sports junkie. It doesn't matter what it is. If it involves a puck, a ball, you know, a racket, a club, a cue, I picked it up and played it. And, you know, unfortunately, I had aspirations, you know, as a lot of young kids do, probably, of playing in the NFL or playing in the NHL or something like that. But, you know, I just wasn't blessed with a 6'5", 250-pound frame in order to get me there. You know, I'm 5'6", 180 pounds soaking wet. So it just, you know, it just didn't work out. But the one thing that I was always good at was pool. And I guess to go back to how I discovered the game, my mom was a really good pool player, and she played pool her whole life, just, you know, darn near. She worked, her parents owned a bar, and so she grew up with the game. And in fact, this is kind of cool. In fact, her side of the, my mom's family is Italian. And so they had a big family, as most Italian families are big, and they were spread out across the country. And without going into too much detail, and maybe you can fill in the blanks, because I'm not supposed to talk about certain things that involve my family that way, but they had a lot of connections. And some of those connections involved some really famous people. And one of those famous people was Willie Moscone. And so Willie Moscone used to come up and do exhibitions at the Duluth Convention Center in Duluth, Minnesota. And he would do trick shot exhibitions, and he would do you know, the whole deal where you pay some money and you can play Willie Moscone for a little while and stuff like that. And he would do those things at the deck at the Duluth Convention Center. Well, every time he would come to town, he would come up with one of my relatives, and they would go to my mom's parents' place. And they had a couple pool tables there, and it was a restaurant. It was a really nice place. Well, he would go up there and play pool, and my mom had no idea who this was. He just knew that it was a family friend. And he used to show her the game. He used to show her how to break and how to stand and how to hit the ball and just really the basic fundamentals and mechanics of the game. And so that's how she started to pick the game up and learn it. Well, it turns out the guy was Willie Moscone. And so that's who showed her how to play the game. But she didn't realize it until she was much later. So really the gist of what I'm saying is that I kind of grew up with the game. So my mom stayed in the bar business. She worked at and managed bars and restaurants and stuff like that for my whole life. And so there were times where she would work and I would go and hang out wherever she was working as a 4, 5, 6-year-old kid. And I'd pick up a cue and play the game. And I was so short, you know, I'm still pretty short, but I was really short then, and I couldn't see over the table. So I'd actually have to take a bar box or a beer box or a stool or a step stool of some kind to stand on to see over the table. And so in the beginning, I would play just with my hand and, you know, play like what I used to call handball without a cue, because I was so small, I couldn't really maneuver a full size cue. So that's how I learned the game. And it was just one of those things where, you know, I just really was drawn to it. And I think it kind of goes back to, I've had this conversation with other people, you know, what is it about kids and the game of pool? Because every time a kid comes up to a pool table for the first time, they're like wowed by it. And they're really enamored. They want to play, and they're really interested in it. And I think it's, at least with pocket pool, it has to do with that instant gratification of making a shot or seeing a ball go in the pocket. So I think those sort of things hooked me. And I guess as I grew up, you know, I was surrounded by the game. My mom played it so much, and she played in leagues and different things like that. And then, you know, people she dated as I grew up were also pool players because she was in that community. And I was really blessed with some really good guys and friends and family friends that played the game and that were really interested in helping me along the way as far as the game of pool. So I had some good teachers and that were really good shots. And so they showed me things along the way. And I was playing, you know, VNEA and ACS leagues in the bar at 14 years old and 13 years old. And I wasn't old enough to be in there, but in Wisconsin, as you guys know, the laws as far as getting into a bar with your parents are pretty lax. You can do it. And the tavern leagues are pretty strong in the state. So we were able to kind of finagle that. And I was always, you know, a well-mannered kid, I guess. And I was really focused on the game and being a good player and, you know, the sportsmanship side of it and stuff like that, being in athletics my whole life. So I was really focused on the game and I wasn't, you know, there to mess around. I was there to play. And so, you know, ever since a young kid, I just was around the game and played it. And, you know, as I grew up, we ended up getting a table at home. So then you play more when you're at home and you have access to it. And, you know, just growing up, my buddies would come over and stuff like that. And it became to the point where it was like too easy for me to play against them and they wouldn't play. So I would play one handed or, you know, behind the back or would just end up, you know, you guys go ahead and play and stuff like that. So I was always around the game and just loved it ever since the first time I seen it. And I think a lot of people can say the same thing. It's just one of those things you really can't pinpoint exactly what it is, but it's just the game is, it's a great game and it just hooked me from the beginning. So I guess, you know, ever since I was a young, young kid, I was just around the game and played it.
Are you still playing a lot, Nick?
You know, as I grew up, that's a good question because I guess I didn't play the game as much as I wanted to anymore until recently. And just kind of like what you mentioned with the Father's Day thing, Demetrius, I mean, life gets in the way. I ended up having a few kids and that took time away from, you know, my table time and stuff like that. But really I went to college and I became a teacher. I'm a teacher. I teach physical education and health. And my real passion is for the game of football. I coach high school football. And again, I wasn't big enough to play the game, but I excelled at it, but I was just small. You know, I was taking a beating when I played and I didn't end up playing in college or anything like that. And so I just stayed around the game and coached. And that's when I started working with kids and really started coaching and different things. I just knew that that's what I wanted to do. And so I changed my major and switched schools and, you know, focused on physical education and becoming a coach. And so that's what I do. I teach at a rural district in Wisconsin and I just love it. I love everything about it. And so that whole process kind of took away from my focus being on pool. And so for about 5-6 years, I really didn't play a whole lot. I would play maybe one day a week. I stayed in league, but that was it. And then within the last 2 years, I really started getting the itch again and really wanting to play more. And so, you know, I started going down to the local pool room and stuff like that more often and picking up the cue more often. And one of the local league operators didn't want to do it anymore. And there was nobody in our area that wanted to pick up the league and run it. And it's a Midwest Pool Players Association sanctioned league that's connected with ACS. And nobody wanted to pick it up. And it was like, we can't just let this league die. It had been around for so long and it was a really good league. And so I threw my name in the hat and I'm good with numbers and stuff like that. Like I said, I'm a stats guy. So it was real easy for me to, you know, plug things into Excel and to run a league. And so I picked it up and I started running this league. And ever since I did that, I really was just, you know, focused on promoting the game and helping the game in the area. And I just kind of noticed the trends. You know, you take a look at our league that we have. And if you took the average age of a player that was in that league, it's north of 45. I mean, and there's 26 teams. So there's 200 players or so in this league. And, you know, a good chunk of them, you know, aren't going to be around forever. So you just kind of see the way, at least in our area, the trends of the game are. And so, you know, I just, for some reason, I was just drawn to that. And I think working with youth is part of that too, and teaching and coaching people. So So I guess, you know, to answer your question more directly, you know, I in the last couple of years, I really started focusing back in and starting to get competitive again and playing in a lot more local tournaments and stuff like that. And I think, you know, within the next few months here, when things start opening up, you know, I think I want to get back involved and travel a little bit and play more competitively.
One question I've got. So this is interesting, is when I was in high school, this is not what got me into pool. But yeah, when I was in high school, we actually had a intramural pool league where a lot of the kids from my high school, well, you know, some kids from my high school, we'd play in a pool league. We had a pool hall with 9-foot tables where, you know, we had youth leagues. And there are pool rooms that have youth leagues. And then there's other areas. You mentioned not being able to go unsupervised or unchaperoned into the area, into the bar, because, you know, it was a bar setup. I know that in Wisconsin, and I guess I'm not even sure what part of Wisconsin you're in, so you're going to have to fill me in. But is there an opportunity? Is there a place for young kids to play pool in your town? And if so, is there anything you could do to bring, since you're involved in the schools and in the youth, is there any way that you could steer that direction?
Well, to answer your question right off the bat, no. There's nowhere that you can go to play pool if you're a kid right now. There used to be a place about 5 years ago. There's a family up here, the Fredricksons, and they've been running pool halls for 30 years in this area. And they own a place in Minnesota. So I'm right on the border of Duluth and Superior. So right on the border of Minnesota and Superior, we're right next to the lake. And so if you drove 5 minutes away from my house right now, you'd be in Minnesota. So we're real close on the border. And in Minnesota, the laws are a little bit different as far as, you know, chaperoning and getting into a bar. But they do allow you... you know, and you can do the same thing in Wisconsin too, I'm sure, but they did have an actual pool hall, an old fashioned pool hall that didn't serve alcohol. And they had, you know, you could go in there as a kid and play. Well, what ended up happening to that place was, the smoking bans came into effect, and most of the kids that came in there for whatever reason at that time, all smoked cigarettes, and just the way it was, you know, 16, 17, 18 year old kids, they all were in there smoking cigarettes when they played, and there was jumping. There were a lot of kids that went in there and played. I mean, it was busy. And once that smoking ban hit and they changed a couple laws over there, I don't know the specifics of it, but there was like a curfew law that they changed and different stuff like that. Once those things went into effect, it just killed that business for them. There was kids just didn't go in there anymore. And so once that happened, they basically closed up, you know, the dry side, I like to call it. I don't know if that's the correct terminology, but the side that didn't have any alcohol so kids could go in and play, and they opened it up and turned it into a tavern that had pool tables, basically is what we have up here. And so ever since that point, there hasn't been a place for kids to go and play. There's just nowhere to go. So to answer the second part of your question, as far as what I could possibly do or if I have ideas, I do. So I mentioned the Fredricksons, and Jerry Fredrickson is the guy who he actually deals now in the antique table business. So he travels the country and installs, you know, real antique, beautiful tables across the country. And he does this for, you know, I guess the higher class and not just the higher class people, but he really works with, you know, really high quality stuff. And that's kind of what the business he's gotten into. He doesn't run pool halls anymore, but he's got, you know, access to a lot of pool tables, and he's got some old Brunswicks and stuff like that. And we had a conversation, and he told me that if I could get, you know, approval, that he would give me a table or two to get into the school system here. And so what my goal's been since I got licensed and got a job and became a teacher is to turn that into either, you know, some sort of elective or a summer school class. I think I'd have more luck doing something with summer school just because of the way, you know, schools are put together now, and there's just really not room for a class itself unless you connected it to physical education, which you could. But what I'd like to do is teach a summer course and, you know, maybe get 8, 9, 10 kids at a time and do, you know, a 5-week course or a 6-week course, something like that, and introduce kids to the game. And he told me flat out that he'd donate me a table. So we've got the equipment. Now we just got to get approval. So I'm working on it. And that's really what I see in the future as far as trying to get kids into the game. Now, on top of that, there's a guy named Jeff Shaleen in this neighbor in our town here, and he owns Top Hat Tavern, and he's a great guy. And he's got visions of this too, because he was a guy who learned how to play the game as a kid and played in junior leagues and stuff. And before the COVID-19 stuff happened, he was doing a Sunday morning or late morning after church kind of thing, youth lessons, where he'd have, you know, players from the area come in and work with a kid one-on-one. And that was just getting going. And then this whole COVID thing happened. So it stopped like 2 weeks into the program. So hopefully, you know, that can get going, and I'm going to help with that. And hopefully that can get going again, and we can sort of, you know, kick this thing in the butt and get kids involved. Because really, I don't think it's that kids don't like the game or they're not interested in the game. I don't think it's that at all. I just think that there's no exposure to the game and there's no access to the game right now. And so that's what we got to work on.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. And if you're able to get, you know, maybe a success story out of your school, maybe you could go to the surrounding schools and maybe your conference and actually try to set up a school-wide type of, I guess, maybe an actual registered sport that you could actually have conference. And, you know, if you could have a conference tournament, maybe you could kind of go to other schools with that in the state of Wisconsin, and maybe you could eventually have a state pool tournament. How awesome would that be?
You know, that's been in my mind. I thought about that, you know, and that'd be amazing. And I don't see why not. I mean, you know, other activities and sports kind of started the same way, right? I mean, lacrosse kind of started the same way. It was a club sport, you know, not many people played it. And all of a sudden, you know, kids started picking it up, and, you know, the clubs popped up around different towns across Minnesota and Wisconsin. And now all of a sudden that's starting to leak into high schools, and now high schools are sanctioning that. So, I mean, it's definitely possible. And I think, you know, the toughest thing is too, and, you know, unfortunately, whether, you know, a lot of pool players want to admit it or not, there's still a negative stigma that surrounds the game. You know, if people who aren't, that don't surround themselves with pool, and you bring that up to somebody and they kind of look at you funny. I've had it happen to me many times where they think, oh, whoa, this, he must be, what kind of riffraff is this guy? He plays pool, you know? And I think, as crazy as it sounds, I think it some of that has to do with the movie The Hustler, such a classic, but so many people saw that movie and, you know, the gambling side of it and you know, the roughneck side of it, and we're going to beat you up if you don't pay and all that kind of stuff, you know, and I think we still have to get over that a little bit, and it's going to be tough possibly in the school systems to convince certain people and powers that be to adopt it. But I think it's possible. We just got to work on it. And I'm gonna do my best to get it started at ground level. Is, you know, if I can find a place in our school to put a couple tables in, and you know, allow that to just be taught as a summer course, as a summer club, I think that's a step in the right direction.
I think this drive to eliminate the hustling and stigma, I think we're going the wrong way. I think we need to bring back the smoking and the underage smoking. I think these kids.
Oh, you stop it right now.
They should be playing for grades. I think you should give everyone some Monopoly money, and whoever's got the most gets an A, and whoever's got the least, they're out. Okay. I don't know, man.
Well, hey, you know what? There's nothing – I don't think there's anything wrong with gambling myself. I mean, there's nothing wrong with playing with something on the line. I think as far – if you're a player that's learning the game and you can change, you know, sort of the outlook and the feeling of what you're doing – I mean, because everybody knows if you're playing around, you're just, you know, playing a guy a few sets for nothing, for fun. You know, it's no big deal. You just kind of play around, and if you miss, you miss. But, you know, even if you throw $5 on the line, you start to focus a little bit more, and it changes, and things become more serious. Anytime there's money involved, things become more serious. So I really don't think it's a negative thing personally, but I just think there's still that stigma out there that hampers the game a little bit. And if we can just keep working and working to – get people to see the sportsmanship side of the game, because really the pool is a gentleman's game. When it boils down to it, it's a gentleman's game. There's so much sportsmanship involved, and just, you know, you look at guys like Shane Van Boning, for example. I mean, one of the most humble guys ever. You know, he misses a shot. He doesn't, there's no antics. He just sits down, waits for his next time at the table, you know? So it's stuff like that. Right. And so I think we just, I agree with you where it's not as big a deal to me personally, but I think for other people it is.
Well, you said the stigma around it, and there's Michael Jordan will not even play golf if he doesn't have $10,000 a hole on it with whoever he's playing with. Phil Mickelson, there's a story I listened to another podcast, and Phil Mickelson basically, if somebody wants to golf with him, the only question he asks basically before saying yes or no is how much are you going to play for? And that's right. basically the deciding factor as to whether or not he's going to golf with you. So definitely the gambling can be done correctly, right? It's the shady part of the game that, you know, nobody's heard of breaking somebody's thumbs in golf for not paying up a bet, right? So it's the stigma around it that I think is the deciding factor between even golf and pool, which is kind of the two sports that get compared the most often. And golf is, if anything, it's probably worse than pool as far as gambling goes. So I kind of agree with Demetrius. I know he was kind of saying it as a joke, but I think he kind of stands with what he's saying too, right? Where the gambling isn't the actual part of it, right?
Well, I think what's interesting actually, and it's, I never really thought of it this way before, but it's this weird, you got to walk a tightrope because if you don't clean it up a little bit, if parents are afraid that their kids are going to be like getting in knife fights in the back alley, obviously that's not good. But on the other hand, it's a little bit of the seediness is what attracts the kids to it. You know, I know that it was like playing pool is cool. Listen, I'm a chess player. I love chess. All right. But like, there's a difference if you had a chess club versus a pool league. There's a different kind of, you know, image. And I think that kids think pool is cool. And if you clean it up and make it too square, I think that takes away a little bit of the appeal. I think part of it is like, this is kind of a cool, you know, grown up activity that's kind of like, you know, a little bit outside of what you'd normally see in a junior high or high school. And so, I think there's a tightrope. You got to make it safe. You have to make it responsible. You have to make it supervised. You know, you have to make it honorable and teach some good values. But it's okay to be a little bit, edgy.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Totally. And yeah, I mean, golf is probably worse as far as that whole thing. But again, you know, like you said, Nate, you don't hear of somebody getting their arm broke or their thumbs broke for not paying up in a game of golf. I mean, I'm sure it's happened across the country numerous times, but you just don't hear about it as much. And so, you know, I agree totally. I think it's part of it that, you know, everybody's got a rebellious side a little bit too. So if you feel a little mysterious or like you're rebelling a little bit by playing the game, it makes it cool. And for sure. I mean, you know, just like you said, chess is great. I love playing chess too. But there's definitely a difference in playing a game of pool versus that or some other activity. And the other part about it too is, again, I think it's that instant gratification. You make a shot or you run a table and you know, the 8-ball drops, or if you're playing 9-ball, the 9-ball drops or whatever. You know, I just think there's more of an adrenaline factor and a rush, and it's more comparable to a physical sport versus anything else. And I think what I've found is once you get a kid, introduce a kid to the game, it doesn't matter, you know, this is the other great thing about pool too. And I don't know if we can get into this if you guys want, but you know, it doesn't matter what ethnicity, what background, you know, what status you are. You know, everybody, the pool community is great. Everybody accepts everybody. I think that's amazing. That's a great part of pool too. But you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who the kid is. Once they play the game a little bit, they really start to get hooked on it, even if it's just, you know, for a little while and they move on to something else. But it's just one of those games that I just think there's so many variables to it and there's so much thinking involved and different things that go into a game of pool that, you know, if we can just get kids to pick the game up and play it, I know that we can, especially in this day and age with YouTube and kids that, you know, if it's right or wrong, kids that want to be famous on YouTube, if they can get famous on YouTube for playing pool, power to them, you know, and let's promote the heck out of that, because that would be a great tool for us to help continue to grow the sport.
Yeah. Well, I think we've pretty much wrapped that discussion up at this point, unless there's anything either of you would like to chat about.
Don't know that you can add much to that. Good job.
Yeah.
No, I think that was good.
All right. So I guess with that, we can head on to... So I think we're probably going to skip the discussion topic for this week. We haven't had any new listener questions. I did have one of them from somebody that I don't remember who it was, and I went back and tried to find it, and I can't. So going back to my really excellent accounting bookkeeping... I have corrected that, I think, in the future, though. I have actually set something up so that I'm not going to be an idiot anymore. But basically, so I guess what I'm saying is anybody with listener questions, please reach out and let us know. We will get them in ASAP, basically. So any questions you have, we will answer them right away. But I guess we can go into our tip segment, and Rob's not here, but Nick, we can do a tip segment. If you wanted to think about yours, I can go first.
Sure, you go first. I'm ready for mine, but you go ahead and go first. I'll give the host the honors.
Okay. Well, so my tip is going to be, if you play in a lot of events, a lot of pool tournaments, it's very common, obviously, to play in your tournaments, and it's kind of in when you go two and out in a tournament, it seems like you'd rather be just about anywhere else in the world than a pool hall, or at least if you're like me, you are. Like, if I go two and out in a tournament, I just want to leave. I don't want to be around pool anymore. It's a bitter feeling, pretty much. But that is actually pretty bad, because you got knocked out of the tournament for a reason, and you're probably going to have the ability to hang around most of the day. At least the tournaments in Wisconsin, the tables are just open. So you pay your greens fee at the beginning of the tournament, and then you play pool all day, whether you're two and out or whether you win the tournament. You can play pretty much all day long. So that would be my tip for this week, is if you get knocked out of a tournament early and you kind of know why, there's no better time to work on the things that you have to work on than right after a pool tournament, because they're fresh in your mind. You know exactly what you need to do to fix them, and you can basically just take a day that you are going to plan on, you know, being there anyways for the entire day. Take that day to work on some of the things that you need to work on. So that'll be my tip this week, is to even if you get knocked out of a tournament two and out or three and out or whatever it is, hang around, take the day, and work on your game on the things that you need to work on.
Not only that, Nate, that's a great tip, but it also gives you the opportunity to sit in the line of the sight of the person that eliminated you and just shark them blatantly during their next match.
Definitely. Maybe throw a beer can at them or something. Yeah, I agree. All right, Nick, why don't you take it away from there?
All right. Well, you know, when you and I talked a couple of days ago about me possibly coming on, and so I started thinking about what my tip would be. And I'm sure maybe this has been covered before on the show, and I'm sure it has. But the biggest thing for me that's helped me, especially recently as I get more serious and picked up the game and played a lot more recently, was the whole mental aspect of it, right? I mean, there used to be guys back in the day, old-timers, that would tell me that the game was 90% mental. And I looked at some of those guys and just thought they were crazy, because as a young kid, you're just pounding balls in the pocket and you're thinking, mental, I can do this in my sleep. I can make that shot in my sleep, you know. But as you get more competitive and you realize as you get further into a tournament and different things, the things that can take a toll on you, how important the mental side of the game is. So the first thing I want to suggest, and maybe you guys have suggested this before, but is I want anybody who's serious about the game, I think you should pick up a book. The book is called The Inner Game of Tennis. And the book surrounds the game of tennis mostly, but it can be connected to any activity or sport that you play competitively. And I'll tell you what, I have the ebook or whatever you want to call it. And I'm going to get the hard copy because I like to see things in front of my face, kind of how I work. But I got the ebook and I've listened to that about two or three times. And I can't tell you how much of that I realize that I do and I shouldn't do, and how to just, it basically just talks about how to clear your mind and see the game for what it is and not for what it isn't. And so, you know, when you miss a shot, and everybody's done this, you miss a shot and you're dwelling on it, you go sit down in your chair and you're just pissed at yourself. How did I miss that? How did I miss that? And you're watching your opponent run out on you and you're just pissed. And it carries over into the next rack, into the next game, into the next match. Those types of things, how can you, inside, how can you internalize that and just remove it from your mind? And that's what the book talks about. So, that's my big tip. The other one I wanted to mention was change the way you look at the game. So I predominantly played 8-ball all of my life, but in the recent few months, I've picked up 9-ball more and started playing 10-ball more. And I really feel like it's improved my game tremendously, because you're just playing a different game. And again, it's just changing the way you look at things. And a lot of people say, you know, people who plateau after a while and stuff like that, and you're not getting any better. The best thing you can do is change the way you look at it and change the game that you play. Play multiple games. Change the way you look at it and work on the mental side of things. So those are my tips.
Well, and I'll tell you what, there's been a, it's great. I think The Inner Game of Tennis is a must read. I, I read it as a kid because it was suggested out of Mastering Pool by George Fells. I've read it to my children, and I've recommended it to all my students. I've actually got a young gun that I'm kind of coaching and sponsoring here out of Minnesota that I'm actually reading it to them. I call them once a week, and we read through a part of the chapter. And so I can't stress it enough. I think it's required reading. Also, the only other thing I'd add to your synopsis is his main premise is that there's two parts. You know, you've got the doer part of – everybody's got a doer and a teller. You know, the part that's analytical and kind of advising and the part that's kind of intuitive and doing.
He talks about
how dysfunctional relationships can develop between the doer and the teller, what problems that causes, and then how you can kind of establish a better relationship so that you're working with yourself instead of against yourself. And very, very good. So good tip.
It's amazing how you don't think about that sort of thing on a normal basis, but when you read that book, you can compare it to yourself and think about all the times you've done those things that it's talked about. And it's amazing. And it's a really eye-opening thing. And I agree. It's a must read.
And it's pretty easy reading for people that, we're talking to some pool players. And so not everybody, you know, some people like more pictures than others. It's pretty easy reading.
Yep. No doubt.
Yeah. Short too, which made me happy. All right. Well, I guess with that, we can go into Demetrius's Coach's Corner. Demetrius, you can take it away.
Yeah. So this week, as I already kind of tickled it up, I've got a question. Actually, it was through my MN Pool Bootcamp Facebook. So anybody that wants to ask me questions, you can email me at info@mnpoolbootcamp.com, MN like Minnesota, or you can check me on Facebook. I've been posting some stuff up here and there. But the question had to do with, you know, this gentleman is – he's been playing pool for 3 years. He's been very excited. He's had some good results out in Vegas. He's played some leagues, and he's been working hard in his game. But he also has a job. He has young children. He's trying to be a good father, responsible citizen. And so he's like, what do you say to somebody that does want to get better, but they just have a lot on their plate and they can't just go off and, you know, go to Neverland and just play pool all day? And so I told him I'd make that my coach's corner. So welcome to the next coach's corner. I think a lot of this is just common sense, but let me tell you what the common sense things I have are. So if you are a busy person that still wants to improve at pool, the first thing you have to do is kind of have an idea of a budget for both time and money. You know, you don't want to be in a spot where it's murky, because then you always feel like you wish you had more. And then at the same time, you know, you might throw your life out of balance a little bit where you're neglecting your responsibilities, or you might feel guilty every time you play, or you might be, maybe your spouse is impatient every time you play. So it's good to have these conversations either with yourself, with your spouse, and just kind of everybody that's involved needs to kind of have a clear picture of what's reasonable for time and money so that you don't go too far, but you also don't feel guilty and pursuing something you love. So whatever that is, and that can change year by year, but you got to have a clear picture of what you can do. Then the second thing you need to do is you need to set the appropriate goals, which is you have to set goals based on your time and energy and money budget. So you can't sit there and say, well, I want to be, you know, if there's other people that are putting in more time and energy around you, you can't, or have a head start in terms of ability. You know, if there's somebody that's two levels above you that's playing every day and they don't have children and they're trying to go pro and they're playing pro events, you can't really set your goal to outplay that person because that doesn't make any sense. You have to look at, with your budget of time and energy, what is a reasonable goal? And for those that have heard me, you'll understand my goal is to use the time and energy and money I have to see how, you know, to go as far as I can within my budget. Not to try to compete with people that have a bigger budget than mine. That doesn't leave, sets you up for failure and frustration. And that's why for those that haven't heard it, I refer back to that joke about the two walkers in the woods that two hikers run into a bear. The first guy starts, you know, putting on his running shoes and the other hiker's like, what are you doing? You can't outrun a bear. And the first hiker says, well, I don't have to, I have to outrun you. And so I go back to that. I'm not trying to outrun the bear. The bear is the player that has more time and resources than I do. I can't outrun the bear. I have to outrun the other hiker. And the other hiker is me, who I was yesterday. And so it's very important. So first, you have a budget of time and money. Then you set goals based on what you can do with your budget to be a better version of you, not how do you stack up with people that are throwing more resources into the game. The third thing I would say is you have to plan and understand that you are going to have ranges throughout your years of fluctuation of energy and focus and attention. So if you, like, for example, when I come back from a tournament, kind of to Nate's point, when I come back from the tournament and I'm thinking about all the things I want to work on and how I want to get better at certain things, well, then what happens is I get home and my kids come tackle me and I've got emails and calls to make and stuff to do. And it's like, oh yeah, it's not like I forgot. I'm not coming back to a vacuum where I can just practice all those things. I'm going to be overwhelmed with life and responsibilities. And so that could be, you know, if you have this idea that you're just going to go home and work on your game, that's going to be frustrating. And there's times when you kind of get into a rhythm where you're practicing and you just have a lot of, you know, mental energy to devote to pool and to think about and to watch pool and practice. But then there's also times when, you know, holidays come and you're running around and shopping for birthdays. And next thing you know, you just don't have a lot of attention to give to the game. So you have to understand that your energy levels and even within your budget, it will fluctuate a little bit. And so you can't set up your action plan based on being able to maintain the high end of your range on energy and attention. Because if you say to yourself, I'm going to practice 2 hours a day, da 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 da, well, that might work for a couple of weeks while you're motivated and focused and you don't have anything going on. But then that wave is going to crash over you and you're going to fall off your plan. And it's going to be easy to get discouraged or defeated and then think that it's all worthless. And then the other problem is if you're at the bottom of your range and you don't have much time to practice that week and much attention to give, it's easy to think, well, I can't stick to my plan, so it's worthless, why bother? It's better to understand, kind of have a multi-pronged strategy, which is when I'm feeling it, I will put in some practice and hard work. And when I'm overwhelmed or not feeling it, I will still do something so that I'm at least not going backwards and not going a month at a time without picking up my cues. And I don't want to live a life where 50% of the time I'm telling myself things like I'll never get there, it'll never work, I'll never add up because I can't do enough. You want to be able to do enough at the bottom of your range to where you're able to tell yourself, I've budgeted for this, I know that these days will come. Now is not when I need to get better. Now is when I just need to hang in the game and understand that I'm not failing. I budgeted for this. And when I have the time and resources again, I'll be able to make my charge and I'll be able to make my move then. So I'm hanging back and waiting to make my move here when things turn around and the seasons change a little bit. So plan on fluctuation with time and energy. And then finally, you have to be strategic. You can't brute force it. There's people that just go to pro tournament after pro tournament, play money match after money match, play 10 hours a day. They can brute force it. They may not have to be as strategic about how they use their time and energy. They're just going to say, I'm just going to throw time and energy at it until I win a pro tournament. But when you have limited time and energy, you have to be more strategic about it. And so you really have to understand your game, what your game can look like, where it needs to improve, how to get from here to there. You have to have a clear vision of where you're going, clear understanding of what physically needs to change to get you there, and what needs to happen in terms of league play, match play, tournament play, you know, practice, what needs to happen, video studies, whatever. What has lessons, coaching, what has to happen to get me from here to there? And then you have to just be more, you have to make sure you're not frittering away energy doing stuff that's not working without direction. And I've seen a lot of people that fall into a trap. They don't feel like they have much time and energy to put in the game. So then they waste 10 years not really focused because they're like, well, I wouldn't have added up to much. Whereas if they actually would have had a plan and consistently put the little bit of time and energy they did have with a little bit of strategy, they could have actually been top master players and regional champions. But they just never really thought they had enough time. So then they pissed away 20 years. So bottom line, to recap, good life pool balance. First, you plan a budget of time and money. Second, you set your goals according to that budget and according to competing with yourself. Third, you budget mentally for fluctuations in your energy so you're not discouraged and negative and defeated half the time. And finally, you have to be very, very clear about what your game needs to look like and what you need to do physically and in terms of career management to make that happen. And for people that are in that range the same way, you know, a lot of people feel that you know, coaching, maybe they're on the fence, but that's what I do. I help with my coaching. People come to work with me. They fly in from anywhere in the country, spend 3 days. And when they leave here, they have a very, very clear picture of what pool, what their game could look like. They know exactly which pieces of their game need to change. They have a plan of what they can do on the table and what they can do in their career to hit those goals. And we've actually already started working on them together so that by the time they leave, they've already taken the first few steps to become better players. And are all they have to do then is follow the plan that we've created and keep the momentum rolling to see that progress. And that, and it's an investment of time and money to come work with me, but it's not nearly the same investment as 30 years of directionless, you know, going through the motions. So I invite anybody that's interested to contact me at info@mnpoolbootcamp.com or check out my website, mnpoolbootcamp.com, to learn more. And hope to thanks for the question. I hope to hear back from this gentleman and find out that that his next tournament out to Vegas is even more successful.
Yeah, for sure. So that I guess that brings another episode to a close. Nick, are you still here?
I am still here.
Yay. Thanks for joining us today, buddy.
Hey guys, I really do appreciate it. And you know, it's been a lot of fun talking to you. I appreciate you giving me the time to ramble a little bit about my show and about my background. Again, I'm just your average pool player from Northern Wisconsin. I'm nobody special, but again, I appreciate you giving me the time.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. And Nick, by the way, I mean, I don't know what you know, I'm kind of near your area. I've played a lot of tournaments out of the Twin Ports, and you know, I've got a few road stories myself. So if you ever wanted me to be involved, just shoot me a message, okay?
Wow, look at this lobbying.
You're booked. We'll talk about it.
Look at this lobbying. Oh my goodness.
Lobbying, man. My stories are gold. I'm doing him a favor, man.
hey, that's what a podcast host wants to hear. You got good stories, you're booked. Let's go.
Well, there you go. He's already had Rob and myself on. You might as well have Demetrius, too. Do the trifecta.
I was just going to say, we'll make it a trifecta. Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. And anybody that wants to check out Chalk is Cheap, you could basically find it on any of the major podcast forums. Other than that, Demetrius, Nick, thank you guys for joining me for another week.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks for the support, Nate. I really appreciate it. And again, I love what you guys are doing. This platform, I appreciate you allowing me to come on. And I can't wait for each and every episode of yours to come out. So, again, keep doing what you guys are doing, too. And we'll keep promoting the game.
Absolutely. All right. Till next week. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/queueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Cue It Up podcast.